Mark Barnes, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
I'm looking forward to this. We are going to be talking about technology today, which for anyone that knows me is a soapbox I like to stand on as frequently as possible, with plenty of irony being a YouTuber and doing stuff on YouTube. So this is going to be fun, though. I'm looking forward to it as we talk about how we might approach technology. Are there good uses of it, bad uses of it? But before we even get into any of that, something that I think is often missing from conversations about technology is maybe just defining technology so that we all know we're talking about the same thing before we get into goods, bads, practicalities, and such. So when you talk about technology, what is it that you're talking about, and maybe specifically in this conversation today?
Austin, I wish I could say I had a simple answer to that, but the word itself is very ambiguous. As we can tell, it's used to mean everything from a sort of field of study to every single device that we own, to the gadgets that surround us. And also sometimes it could just mean something like a shovel or a rake. So there's a, unfortunately, a really broad number of applications of the term. And this itself should point to something problematic about technology today, is that we all use this word, and it has such an influence on our lives, and we seem to feel both liberated and constrained by it, but we have a really hard time nailing down exactly what it means. So for the sake of our conversation, I'll say, look, first of all, I don't mean the sum total of things you could call technological devices. I don't just mean, add up all the tools, and I mean a form of making. Techne, the Greek, means to make, and indicates a kind of making. The oddity is that the word technology doesn't really come to be used until the last 200 years or so. And when it was first used, it didn't indicate a category of or a way of engaging with the world, or a category of devices and inventions. It actually indicated a sort of like a list of tools. So you might have a technology of a certain trade or craft, and it would list all the different techniques and tools of that trade or craft in a book. And that was a technologia. Now the word both has that Greek techne, which means making, and ology, which we think of as a form of study. And the oddness of that is important, because I do believe that what technology truly is a form of knowing. It's a way of knowing that reduces everything to human making. And a technological device is not the sum total, but is rather the fruit of that mode of being. So I think technology is not just a result. It's also the kind of mode that human beings enter into to get to that result. That might seem pretty complicated, but I think I could maybe explain it in a simple way. Technology is, our technologies are things we use to fix problems or perceived problems. So when we see a lack, when we see a need, a technological device is something that helps remedy that lack or meet that need. And the technological attitude then, which allows us to produce technological devices, is a view of the world that sees lack or sees need. And this is where technology becomes, I think, both liberating and constraining. Why we both praise technology on the one hand and also kind of fear it on the other is that you never really have a technological device without insinuating it to some degree that there is some lack, some illness, some death, some problem that needs to be solved. And ultimately, the difficulty about living a life that's surrounded or drenched in technological devices is that the technological attitude, instead of being limited to just this or that problem, you know, like to have, say, well, we have this problem that we need to bury our dead, and this shovel helps us to dig the grave. A technological attitude has a tendency to become the way we view everything. So our whole view of the world becomes a view of the world as lacking and in need of improvement, a view of the world as broken and in need of fixing, a view of the world as essentially requiring human intervention and our own, the work of human hands in order to be known. I hope that's helpful.
I think it is, but I think it's one of those things where, you know, does the fish know it's wet when it's swimming in the water, right? Like, these are the waters that we're swimming in for a lot of people. And so I think a helpful way of getting at this might be to paint a little bit of a picture of what would the alternative look like? Because I think some people might be tracking along with that response and say, well, the world is such that we have these problems that need solutions and we make solutions to them. And so could you maybe give us the inverse to this? What would a non-technological approach to the world be? What kind of lens would we be seeing through in that way? Would be kind of the opposite of this.
Well, I think we've all experienced forms of making, of techne, that seemed to be called forth from us from the very natures of things in the universe and not from a perception of our own lack and need. One example that's very easy to give, though I hope it doesn't make people think that all the examples are like this, is building a sandcastle, right? So if you're on the beach and you start to fiddle with the sand and eventually form it into a little tower, you're responding to something real about the sand. You understand it has a certain nature. It can be formed. It can be shaped. And you're responding to it and bringing it to a sort of perfection, adding human labor to it. But it's not because there's some need that's driving you to it. You're not going to starve if the sandcastle isn't good. I don't think anyone's paying for ad space on your sandcastle. I think it's a more simple form of making. And that form of making is possible, I think, throughout human life. I think, in fact, all the best things in human life tend to have some alternative form of making that we would describe as not technological. So one way to look at this is just to look at the Bible and to ask the question of Adam in the garden. Now, we know in faith that Adam in the garden did not face death, but by grace was saved from death and from suffering, and Adam had infused wisdom of God. So he had intimate knowledge of the nature of things. He wasn't separated from them. And so when he worked, what was he doing? Now, this is a very difficult question for us because our world is full of lack. It is full of difficulty. And so it's sometimes easy to think, well, then the only kind of making that would come forth from man would be motivated by lack and difficulty. And indeed, many of the liberal theologians of the 19th and 18th centuries, mostly the 19th century, did argue this. Malthus is very famous for this. And he argued that God gave Adam suffering prior to his fall, prior to his sin. He gave Adam suffering and he gave him lack and the threat of death as spurs to his action. And man is then conceived as this sort of beast that has to be whipped along in order to become creative and intellectual and to build. I don't think that's right. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I think rather the human person is like a shepherd. He's put in the cosmos, not just as another object in it, but as another theologian, Aquinas, says, as a cause of its perfection. So when he looks at the ground, the earth, the trees, and begins to work and shape them, it's because he is bringing them to their completion. He is finding what they're capable of, and he is tilling, he's keeping, he's making structures and shelters. Who knows exactly what he's doing in the garden, but he can see it all as a harmonious being in harmony with the world in such a way that he belongs to it as its perfecter, as its keeper, as its shepherd, as its tiller, as the one who's supposed to help things become what they are. And that, I think, is the alternative. So I think technology is old as sin. Because the moment you have lack, then you have a different motivation, a different kind of making. You know, Adam, who's going to till because if he doesn't, he'll starve to death, is doing something different than Adam tilling because it belongs to the perfection of the soil to be ordered by man into something fruitful.
So if we were to put maybe some moral categorization on these things, is it such that whether it's Adam or us later on, but when we are in a kind of post-fall situation where there is lack in the world and we make out of a desire to kind of problem solve rather than simply to perfect nature, is it the case that that very making you would describe as bad, or it's a solution amidst a bad environment? And I guess the reason I'm asking this question is it kind of gets at, well, is technology inherently bad, or is it something that arises out of a bad situation? Does that distinction make sense?
Absolutely. And definitely the latter is correct. You know, when Adam is cursed to toil the ground, because if he doesn't, he will die. When he's taken, alienated from that wisdom, that intimate familiarity he had with all of the creatures over which he was Lord, when he disobeyed God and abdicated that relationship, that harmonious relationship, it wasn't bad for him to then toil with the ground in the sense of morally condemnable. In fact, in some ways, it's him taking his punishment, humbling himself, and learning his place again. All of which is to say, I don't think it's bad. I think that it's remedial. So good technology knows the limits of the problem. What I mean is good technology says, here is a real instance of lack, and here is a sort of human labor, a making, a work, a technology that is oriented to the fulfillment of that lack. But good technology ends there. When the lack is filled, that's it. The lack is filled, the problem has been solved. And that's not really what we see with our world. We don't see that kind of limitation of technology because we don't see a limitation of the idea of the world as lacking. What we don't have is a fundamental sense that the world is good, and that when sin and disaster take us away from that good, that we can restore it to its proper perfection. Instead, we have a sense of the world as infinitely improvable, and everything that exists having a kind of infinite lack within it that always can bear more technology. And so I do think, you know, at the end of the day, it's our virtue and our vice that determines the extent of technology. So to answer your question, I don't think it's bad to use a technology to remedy a lack. But if you look at our lives, it's very obvious that we are not a people who have just used technology to remedy our lacks. In fact, currently, many of our lacks and frustrations and needs simply come from technology. You mentioned before we started talking being stuck in traffic and the frustrations that involves. And that's something that it's a technological problem you got there.
It is indeed. And I actually think it could be helpful to put a little bit more structure to this idea, because I think the concept for people that we take technology, that we make technology to solve a problem, but then we extend it beyond that. And we try to seek kind of constant improvement across all domains. That might be might be understandable for some people, might be a bit ethereal for others. And I've heard you use several different examples on New Polity. I was listening to some on the way into DC today. And one of those ideas is the car. And maybe we could use this as an example of solving a problem of long distance travel, but how we extend it beyond that. I'll let you kind of extrapolate on that though, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I mean, the car, oh man, there's so many things you can say about the car. You have to kind of reel yourself in a little bit. Yeah, ostensibly the car is a solution to a certain problem of distance. And so I suppose there's a possible world in which a car could be a just nothing but a wholesome healing technology, in the sense that you use it to make up that problem of distance, and that's it. But as we know, the actual use of the car in our country, it wasn't just utilized to solve a particular lack. In fact, it was aggressively marketed to people, to everyone, that everyone needed to have a car because they lacked something that previously they didn't know they lacked, namely to be able to leave where they were, to visit new places, and to get out of the cities and into cheaper land that's available in the suburbs. What I mean is, there was a very obvious effort within our society to extend the use of the car to everyone, to make it part of our natural need almost. And the result is that now you really can't do without a car. So what begins as a solution to a problem becomes a new necessity in human life, because it brings problems that only cars can solve. One of the obvious examples of this is just how spaced out everything is. You know, when you have a car and you're in a world that is largely built for people on their feet, then that car really is an improvement, at least in terms of distance and speed, on your life. But as we respond to that and start to build the car, the world, according to the logic of the car, we start to build our houses in one place, our bars and restaurants in another, our work in a third place, until the world becomes inaccessible unless you do have a car. So what begins as almost a luxury, or at least you might say an improvement, ends as just a kind of slavish necessity. We all have to drive. And so it no longer excites us like a new technology once excited us. And I think if you look at any of our major modern technologies, you'll find exactly the same trend as the car, that something that begins as an exciting new possibility that's going to improve something in human life ends pretty quickly by being a rote necessity that if you don't have, you become marginalized, poor, or otherwise excluded from normal life. So a phone is a very good example. One example I like to use is not just the phone itself, because I think people can see how, you know, a phone, which begins as a technology that improved and sort of in an exciting way added to human power, has become something that you can't do without in any way whatsoever. You can't even find your way around in a place without a phone at this point. One thing that I noticed, I don't know if you noticed this, but growing up, I remember when emojis became a technology available to all of us. It was a thrilling time for sure, where suddenly you had a new capacity granted to you by this technological device. You were able to express your emotion just by choosing a yellow face with its smile, its tears, its tongue sticking out, whatever it was. Suddenly this lack, which was obviously a lack already created, you know, by the phone, suddenly this lack was alleviated, that you can now express your emotion in situations of ambiguity clearly. But then as people took up the technology of the emoji, I've noticed something interesting start to happen, which is that people became unable to express their emotional states without the use of emoji. And indeed, they felt a great deal of anxiety if they received a text that said something like, "Hey, I'm over here," without a winking face or a smiley face to kind of assure a emotional mode that the message was supposed to be received in. People became very nervous and anxious, and emojis, which once, you know, you could add on as a sort of augmentation of human texting, have now become something very necessary. People feel almost naked if they don't have them to use. And so something that's, I think you can see this in, like I said, it's in cars, it's in phones, it's in the design of our cities. It's obvious in more vicious forms of technology. I mean, something like pornography is an obvious example of the way that something which begins and insinuates itself in people's lives as an augmentation, like we're going to give you sexual arousal as a technologically available commodity, quickly becomes an addiction, becomes something that you now need pornography in order to get that good of human sexuality that you had without pornography. And I think we all understand this about technology, that the problem is not when it solves our problems. The problem is when it insinuates itself as a need, when we know that we don't actually need all of this stuff to live and to be happy and to be well and to be virtuous and to ultimately be holy. But in our society, in our technological society, every device is marketed as if we did need it, and as if human life really was lacking without it. And so inevitably, well, maybe not inevitably, but in fact, we end up creating worlds which rely on the very technological devices that were supposed to augment human life. And so we feel enslaved to them. We feel like we have a million crutches all around us. And we start to desire, you can sense this urge within a technological society to sort of strip all of it away and just somehow be sufficient without them.
But we're really bad at doing that, it seems. You know, if I talk to people, especially I think people my age, I find they will recognize two things simultaneously. One, that their phones are killing them, or maybe not killing them, but they're killing, phones are killing us. Like we're less happy, we're more anxious. We are spending way more time on screens than doing things that we'll actually find fulfilling. And they're not making us happy. They're not solving the problems that they promised to solve, at least the more existential ones. They recognize all those things on the one hand. On the other hand, if I were to look at their screen time, I mm-hmm. would say that for all of the amount that they might agree that phones are bad, that they might assent to the idea that it's not making them happier, they still engage with them at pretty amazing amounts of time that yeah. we're handing over to these things. So we recognize it's bad, but we're also not very adept at extricating ourselves from it. And we have all types of answers around practicalities for this, but I'd be curious just your kind of high level diagnosis on that. Why is it that we recognize that these things are bad, whether it's our phones or it's non-walkable cities?
Sure.
But we're not very good at making progress on it.
Well, I mean, the first answer that should always be in our minds as regards ourselves is that we're fat, lazy, and comfortable, and we like to be that way. And in any technological society, any successful technology is only really avoided with a certain degree of suffering. I mean, even if you kick back from a smartphone to a dumb phone, which is hardly a major sacrifice, you become less able, within your society, there's just certain things you can't do as well. Like you can't receive a video explanation that someone wants to give you, or, you know, and to then go without a phone at all is almost unthinkable. So what I mean is, on the one hand, we should never forget our propensity to avoid becoming virtuous. But I don't think that's a sufficient explanation. though it's Lent right now, so that's the one I'm going to give first, because I think we need some lashing of ourselves. But the other explanation is sort of the one I've given, that Austin, the world really does take the shape that we give it. Mankind are given this task of building the world into a definite shape. And, you know, you and I believe, and I do believe it's true that we're supposed to build it into a fitting work of praise. But that in sin, we build it to other ends. But it really is the world that we build. We don't have this like other natural world that we can just jump back to, that's just waiting there for us. So what I mean is, the institutions that were in place that were replaced by technologies really are replaced. It's not the case that we have vibrant communities, for instance. It's the case that through the increasing use of technological devices, we destroyed those strong institutions that were supporters of communities. So an obvious example is that basically as television and telephones increased after the wars, you saw a simultaneous decline in all fraternal organizations. I'm talking about Elks, Moose, Masons, even the churches, right, saw the same decline, which is especially unfortunate because it seems to indicate that a lot of folks just viewed the church as a fraternal organization. But once those are gone, they're gone, and they take a lot of work to rebuild. So a person right now who wants to say, look, I just want to do without my phone and meet with people face to face, has shockingly less opportunities to meet with people face to face. I mean, he probably doesn't have a local grocery store. It's probably the case that he doesn't have a place to drink within walking distance, but somewhere he'll have to drive, and which, because of the nature of various technologies, will not be the a pub of a community or a local gathering place, but will actually be something where many communities are coming to, so he can expect strangers to be there and not friends. It's the case that church attendance has dwindled radically. It's the case that people have less friends, period. I mean, there's studies on this. They've been asking men and women, how many friends do you have who you can trust? I don't remember the numbers exactly, but basically since they've been asking, it's been in steady decline, to the point that there are many people living now who say there's only one person, if any, that they can really talk to and trust. So this is to say that, I mean, this is specific to communication technology. We are habit-building creatures, and when we get into the habit of using a technology for communication, those other forms don't just hang out there. They usually go within a generation, right? Because you might be someone, you know, you think of someone who's older than us, maybe in his 50s or 60s, probably uses just as much technology, but remembers the time when, remembers the time when there was a bustling neighborhood, when there was a corner store down the street where he met his friends, was part of the Elks, was part of whatever. And he understands the technology as a sort of replacement. He can kind of live in a world in which both of those things exist. But for the generation growing up, for whom the communications technology isn't some new thing introduced into their life to augment it, but it's in fact just life, you know, like a 13-year-old with a phone now is not someone who has replaced some previous form of community and communion with technological means, but is in fact given community as a technological commodity from the very beginning of their lives. They would have to actually build the institutions that are now gone in order to have an alternative. They would have to actually do something radical in order to have the kind of world that pre-existed the technological world now. And I think this is true of any technology. The car is obviously another good example of this. Like if you say, okay, well, I'm going to just get rid of my car and have all of the joys and beauties of being on my feet, being one with the world and not relying on this crutch to go from space to space, but being sufficient unto myself, having travel, transportation, not as something I pay third parties for, but something that belongs to me as a virtue. Okay, that's great. And that's beautiful. And I love to hear it from people. But the moment you get rid of the car, there is no world for you. There is no walkable world, not in this country, right? Like there's no, I mean, I think of my own little town. It's like, we didn't have a grocery store in the downtown for a while. And if you didn't have a car, it wasn't like you had an option. You just started to eat at the gas station nearby because the world did not exist for feet. The world was built for cars. And so if you didn't have a car, you could not easily reach fresh food, or you couldn't really get groceries. And so started eating the little, you know, the hot dogs on the rollers and Mountain Dew and such. Anyways, you're getting me a little bit ranty. I apologize.
No, these are good things. And I do want to maybe tap into the spirit of ranty though here for a bit, because I see some people in maybe circles I run in that come across things like this, and they go down this rabbit hole of just real kind of anger and frustration, and maybe some of it's justified, but it goes something like they hear this conversation and they begin saying, in generations past, we traded these real existential goods of community, of connectedness, of all of these things for these really fleeting alternatives that aren't living up. And they begin seeing some of their own anxiety, depression, loneliness. And yep. They say, this isn't actually all my fault. This, like, you guys kind of did this to me. And
oh, yeah.
There's, of course, yeah. Areas of responsibility and all of these things. But I completely understand how people can feel that. But where do we go from there? I mean, besides moving to Steubenville. No, I'm just kidding. But like, I'm actually interested in what you guys are attempting to do. And I think it could be insightful for this conversation. But But to that person who's hearing this and is saying, yeah, you're right. Yeah, like they all just messed up the world. And now I was given a phone at 12 and I mm-hmm. only work through my laptop. And I have lost all of these things and there is no community and there's no corner store.
Yeah.
And they're just frustrated. What do you say to those people? Like, what's the message moving forward from that place?
Well, that's a really good question, Austin. I mean, unfortunately, I think they're right. It is the case that very unscrupulous and vicious men have cashed in on almost every human good in attempt to make it something that we rent from them at the price of actual cash, at the price of our attention span, at the price of our brand commitment, at the price of the point being that increasingly we've been handed access to human goods that are only really available through rental payments to these third parties, right? So you get communication if you pay a certain amount to, you know, Facebook, and you get education if you pay a certain amount to Google, and you get sexual arousal if you pay a certain amount to pornography companies, and you get transportation as long as you have the car, and increasingly not even that, right? Like as long as you have money for the Uber and all that. Okay, so that is the trend, and that really was the logic, and it still is. I mean, it is the logic of our society to look for places where human goods exist peacefully and happily and are enjoyed, and to try and create ways to insinuate a device as the way of accessing those goods, making it a marketable area, making it, I mean, the word is commodification, I think. So you try to turn something that people have into a commodity. I guess I'm just one of those people who express their frustrations at this way of doing things. It seems like in a society in which we share a common goal and of happiness and peace, we should not look to replace existing moments of happiness and peace and goodness with a device that can attain it. But we should look at ways of strengthening things that we enjoy, strengthening marriages and families and beautiful cities and face-to-face communication. And so if we have been deprived of this, I mean, one place you might begin is to look at the very prophetic work of C.S. Lewis called The Abolition of Man, where he diagnoses, I suppose, precisely the relationship that your character here is speaking of. He says that, you know, man doesn't actually become more powerful through technologies. Maybe the man who first invents the technology has a certain power over other men. In some ways, he's more powerful, he's able to do, he has capacity. But for the next generation, after the world has been made in the image of the technological device, whatever it is, they are powerless. They need the device. They are dependent on men who have gone before them. And in many cases, like there's... Yeah, in many cases, especially in my area in the Rust Belt, it's not even just the direct dependence that sometimes we feel of, you know, the way that a, like you mentioned, a 12-year-old with a phone might sort of grow angry about this direct dependence he has on a whole conglomerate of older, wealthier men who are running the, you know, the Verizon wireless situation, the Wi-Fi hookup and all that's involved in that. The phone itself. Okay. But it's also like in the Rust Belt, you find reliance on technologies that were from generations that have passed away, and they still influence and affect us. Like I'm thinking of railroads, especially. We had this crisis nearby our town in East Palestine where there's a derailment, and a very poisonous material was flooded out into the world. And it was very dramatic because they decided to set it all on fire in order to get rid of it. But in a big way, those technologies, the kind of workings of them and their intention and their purpose is known by less and less people. I mean, who are our railroad? Do you see what I'm saying? Maybe that's not very clear, but we even become beholden to older technologies when we don't even have an experience of belonging to them anymore, or like even participating in them. We just have them around. They've become just a part of our whole society without really concern for us. So I think, yeah, but what do you do? That's what you asked. Well, I think you have to be honest that the solution will have to be from a different ground. It'll have to come from a different ground than the problem. So the problem of technology right now is not something that is going to be solved by simply more technology. That's been the attitude, I think, of the last, well, it's just been our attitude for quite some time now, that if there's a technological problem, then there's a technological solution. So if we introduce the technology of social media and it turns out to be associated with increased loneliness, well, then we can get therapists who are available to people online through social media, essentially, and give drugs given to people in the mail to solve the problem that the alienation of our communication has already affected. But I think that if we're really going to not just be angry at the situation, but have some peace about it, we can't just look for what's the Christian technological solution that we're going to insert here. But we really have to rebuild older forms of getting along, older forms of getting by. And they don't all have to be older. I don't mean older as if, like, just because we used to do it one way, it's better. But I mean, you might have to start a fraternal organization. You might have to, if you're feeling angry, then that anger might be a call to, I don't know, it's hard to know people's concrete instance, but say you've come to realize the degree, the immense degree to which you are utterly dependent on a massively industrialized technological system in order to have food. And maybe that makes you angry. Well, you might have to start a garden in order to reduce some of that dependence that you have. And then you might have to band with a few like-minded others to get some common property and do more serious growing to start to work in such a way that you actually see people's faces and to start to live out older forms. And what this requires is a great trust that we're not insufficient. Instead, we say, okay, I know that I am taken care of. I know that the universe is abundant and God watches over me, and that I'm supposed to be in harmony with this world. So now, what actions do I do? Now, what actions do I take? And I think that's something that everyone should do.
A couple of things from that really stand out to me. The first is, it's a simple observation, and it should be intuitive, but I think it's not for many of us. And it's that idea that given how serious these problems are, and I think most people who look at them see these as serious problems, we shouldn't expect the solution to be super easy. But yet somehow we seem to think that is the case. We seem to think that, you know, if I can just set up like a time limit on my apps, or if I can kind of switch from this phone to that phone, or if I can, you know, just take this Christian spin on it, if I can replace like my secular app with my Christian app, it's all going to be good. But that it's somewhat counter, that very notion that it would be easy is counterintuitive to the nature of the seriousness of the problem. The second thing that really stood out to me from that is the sense of when we're thinking about technology, and because as we said at the beginning, it's not that every technology is bad, but it seems that we only seem to evaluate technologies in terms of what problems does this solve? Does this increase kind of trivial pleasure? And does it give like time and money back to me in some way? But if we also think about everything that's on the other side of the equation, everything we're giving up, you know, we shouldn't just be asking, what does this give me? But what do I have to give to it? And is that actually a good trade? And I think when we begin to look at that, as you said, we could see like, oh, if this saves me 10 minutes, but it costs me abiding friendships in my life,
right,
that's a really bad trade. But we make it all the time because we don't look at the other side of the equation, or we choose to be blind to it, or we're just so addicted to kind of fast pleasure. So those are really all really interesting to me. I want to, as we kind of come towards the end of this here, I want to get into some practicalities here, though, because I think that is going to be helpful for people. We've had a lot of kind of good high-level discussion, and we've been moving into practicalities, and I want to just drill down a little further. One thing that I couldn't help but want to bring up when I heard that you were doing this was that you guys have an upcoming conference in Steubenville. I think it's Shall We Then Destroy the Servers? Or is it, should we? Shall?
Yeah, I don't know. It's the worst conference title we've ever come up with, but I like it. Should we therefore destroy the servers? Yeah.
Ah, yes. Terrific. Have you put it on a t-shirt? It should be on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Okay. And rumor has it that at this conference, you will be debating the resolution on prayer apps being fitting. I don't know exactly how the resolution is stated. I don't want, you know, to give away all your best arguments, however you want to answer this. But I am curious, because what I think prayer apps represent to people is a case study on one way of approaching this is we live in a technological society, so we must use technology to meet people where they are, even if that's just making incremental improvements in the midst of something that is ultimately in service to a way of being in the world that's not ultimately healthy. It's still better than the alternative. And it seems like in this debate, you will be taking the position of it's not. So could you talk a little bit about how prayer apps, maybe not even just specifically, but how they might represent that way of thinking of let's take the technology, do something good with it, even if the kind of underlying way of being that technology presents is maybe not good for us.
Yeah. The first thing to ask when people suggest that, it's a tough question, because on the one hand, I think people are quite right. Like, we do have an obligation to evangelize and to teach and to pray for each other in this world, right? So I don't simply get to engage with people medievally, as it were, as much as I would like that to be my world. It's not my world. And so even as I can recognize the great damage and trauma that technological dependence has wreaked on our world, it doesn't mean that this is somehow a pass on engaging with it. But when Christians use technologies for the sake of Christianity, if I can be kind of broad about that and not address prayer in particular, when they use it for the sake of Christianity, they have to realize that many and most of the platforms that they use have goals that are not their goals, right? And that this is actually detrimental to the faith to try and use it or try to live out the faith in and through devices that have goals that are inimical to the faith. So like an example of this, something like Facebook or Twitter or any really social media platform, the goal of the platform is not the goal of the gospel. The goal of the platform is very simple. It's trying to maximize the amount of time spent using its particular mode for the sake of ultimately monetization, which has different paths, but usually involves the number of advertisements or promoted posts and such that you see on that app. Now, this can be very different. Sometimes it's subscription models where you're paying money each month, so the goal is to get you to continue to pay that money. Sometimes it's very convoluted what the goal is, because it's a bizarre way in which they have a bunch of venture capitalist funding, so they're giving you something that appears to be free for a while, addicting you to it until the source of that apps or that that social media platform's funding can't be just the startup fund anymore, and then it becomes monetized. So this is usually, it's the life cycle of social media. It always starts free. Everyone's like, I can't believe it. And then all of a sudden they're like, what? They're putting ads on Twitter or whatever it is. It's like they've been betrayed. The goals are not the same as the goals of Christianity. And so we end up, in order to succeed at those platforms, having to speak a certain language and to act and behave in a certain way in order to meet the goals of the platform, which aren't necessarily the goals of Christianity. So for instance, I think we all know that, like, if you were to simply speak the earnest truth about Christ through social media, that you would get no attention. you would be posting yourself out there into nothingness. You would say true things. God loves every single one of you. He has mercy on us. We need to, you know, whatever you say, it would be true. But the nature of the platform is that it prioritizes those things that get engagement, that keep people on their platform for a long time, that make them anxious or nervous, and so attached to it. So like, you can do a great Christian thing online, but you got to make sure that you're, you know, somehow also critiquing, Trump, or you have some kind of present moment engagement with it that allows it to succeed within social media. You have to start fights. You have to start. So I think everyone knows that I don't think it requires much argument to say that sincerity and holiness don't sell well online, and that anyone who wants to have a kind of media presence can't use sincerity and holiness to that end. And with prayer apps, I mean, there's a very similar problem. It's like, if people were just giving away things for free, I mean, if they really were saying like, look, it's a technological world. So we've designed this thing, and it doesn't have this goal of profit. It's not traded on the public on the market. It's just, it's a loss for us and it's a gain for you. Then I think it really could do that kind of work. All things being equal, I think it could do that work of meeting people where they're at and giving them something Christian, something good within their technological dependencies. So I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying that just like the Christian in his normal life should expect that when he really takes Christianity seriously and tries to draw back from pleasures and draw back from these dependencies to man and just try to depend on God, that he is going to have difficulty, that he is going to be cut out of certain spheres of power and influence and the kind of seamlessness of existence, and just the same way that we expect that in terms of our individual lives, I think we should also expect that in terms of our Christian sort of digital institutions. If you really take away the motivation of money, if you really take away the motivation of attention, if you really stop judging things on the metrics of views and clicks, et cetera, you will not be successful. Like, it will not be a successful venture. To be a successful venture and to justify the whole thing to your investors, you tend to have to propose a model of addiction to show how this is how people are going to become plugged in and addicted and need this thing we're offering. And if you can't show that, it's unlikely that the thing's really going to come to exist outside of genuinely charitable works. I hope that makes some sense.
I think it does. I think it might be helpful for people just to hear maybe how you guys have thought through this at New Polity. Because you have a YouTube channel and a podcast, and clearly you all haven't just kind of jumped into this willy-nilly. I imagine there were many late-night philosophical talks over whether to do this. Maybe I'm projecting that onto you, but that would seem to be the case. And so how did you guys make that calculus of YouTube does have different goals than you ostensibly have, and to succeed on YouTube you're kind of trading for people's time and attention, but yet you guys have content to share that I think, and I believe that you all would agree, is good for people to hear. It's helpful, it's beneficial, it can really make an impact for people. So how do you do that equation, if you will? And maybe that's a overly mathematical way of putting it, but How do you make that decision?
I mean, it's a decision I think we all make at every moment. We all know what works. Like if you're doing a YouTube video, what's going to work is having a certain length, having a certain kind of attention grabbing thumbnail, having a topic that's aggressive and usually has some enemy that it targets, that immediately appeals to people who already have that enemy and adds a sort of ammo to their magazine. I'm sorry, magazine in the sense of a gun, not our magazine. That you are going to make content that is tailor fit for posting. What I mean is your goal when you produce something with a piece of writing or a conversation like this one, your goal is not to convey the truth, not to preach, but is in fact to provide the ability for someone else to use what you have made as a part of building up their identity, as a part of their self almost. Because what we look to posting to do is to heal us in some way of this very fragile, alienated, isolated existence, where we need to assure ourselves that we are real, that we have substance, that we're not just a picture, that we matter, that we are loved, that we are righteous. We want these things, but we are increasingly alienated from experiencing these things because we have, on the one hand, no faith, but on the other hand, we have a kind of life that reduces us to this image of ourselves. And so what we look for in the world of YouTube is for something that can shore up this fragile image. We look for things to post to be able to assure ourselves of the goodness of our own reality. And that means that whatever, you know, the content creators are doing, if it's going to succeed, it's going to give people that solution to their anxiety. It's going to be a weapon. It's going to be something that they can say, you know, posting this because that's who I am. You're not challenging people. You're not asking them to listen. You're rather trying to give them ammo in their work, which is the construction of the self online. And so that general problem becomes very, it's quotidian. It means that if you're going to not do that and you're actually going to try and preach, the truth and do it beautifully, then you are going to have to resist the temptation to be, inflammatory, to be deliberately stupid about an idea just because by oversimplification of it, it becomes more effective in, you know, being more clearly something that a conservative Christian will like, or something that a leftist will like, you know, whatever it is. So that is just a matter of, I think, temperance, that habit that we practice to just say no to, you know, the immediate pleasure. It's also just a matter of not putting a paywall between people and God. So one of the things we do is we have a magazine that we do get subscriptions for, but we try not to monetize anything that we don't have to, if that makes sense. So for instance, like sometimes people ask us to give talks, and if our talk is if it's directly spiritual or it's for the sake of especially doing any kind of expository work on the Bible, then we try not to we don't ask for any payment. Now we might say, hey, we can't really make this unless you get us to wherever you are, where you want us to do the talk. But we don't have like a charge, as it were, because we think that is the sin of simony, where you put a cost on the, or put a price on God. They don't want to do that. So there's that. But it is a work of great care. And I don't think we've necessarily always done it right by any means. But I think that you do have to say, look, our goals cannot be the goals of the algorithm. We have to be okay with that. That's fundamental. If any Christian can't make that move in honesty, then I don't think that they should touch a computer with a 10-foot pole. And for this reason, I think actually I was looking at New Polity and I was like, man, we are just solidly in the 1,000 to 2,000 views per video, like place of YouTube. I mean, thinking about YouTube, that's where you are. We have other, you know, on podcasts and such. But I think what I mean is like there's a price for that, right? It's not like you get to avoid the shenanigans by which technology is so addictive and then somehow still succeed and still be the most popular thing. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I hear that. And I think it's something that I hope anyone considering getting into this considers. I've had to learn so many of those lessons in real time. And I think, especially in a lot of traditions of like, let's reach as many people as we can. Let's, you know, bring the gospel to people. We don't think about what costs are coming in the way that we do these things. And I think we sometimes become these like utilitarians when it comes to like just how the most people as quickly as we can without thinking of kind of virtue and what that does in the people doing it. So I think those are really important. Mark, this has been fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. It's clear to me that you've been thinking about this for a long time. And so for people who want to learn more, who want to go deeper, are there any resources you recommend? Obviously, you guys have talked about this on New Polity. You've got the conference coming up. Do you have any favorite writers on this for people that want to take the next step?
Jacques Ellul wrote a book called The Technological Society that I think is very good, but it is very lengthy. So I don't necessarily want to recommend that. I was thinking of Heidegger too, but I don't want to recommend, who wants to recommend Heidegger at the end of a podcast? I guess no, I don't have anyone. You might try. Here's a good one. So at our conference in Steubenville, which I should say is May 23rd to May 25th in Steubenville and is open right now. And you can get a ticket to the conference at newpolity.com/events. At the conference is a gentleman named Matthew Crawford. Matthew Crawford's an incredible philosopher who seems to have derived most of his philosophy from auto mechanics, just from work on his car and from blood, sweat, and tear through various automobiles. And he wrote a book called Shop Class as Soul Craft. And this, it was a bestseller. I'm sure you can find it, but I would definitely recommend that because it very clearly shows what it's like to strive for a use of technology that isn't dependent, that isn't just dependence, but is actually involves virtue and skill. It seems like that's what we're missing, is that we have so much technology as a sort of necessary consumption. Like we have to consume this and we don't know it. We don't know what it is. We don't know how to fix it. We don't know how we would do without it. And what Matthew Crawford shows is a way of relating to our technology where we really do retain some of the mastery of Adam in the garden, where he has a certain, where he is still lord over the thing and not being lorded over by the thing. That and C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, I mentioned that. I think that's a really good start for anyone who's thinking of technology and beginning to realize, oh my gosh, this is a social thing. This is out of my hands. This isn't just something that, you know, I make a few changes and suddenly, you know, I'm living the natural, simple life. It's really a dramatic social thing. C.S. Lewis knew this. He saw this. He saw it present in the radio and the atom bomb and the technologies of his age. And he saw this future of great dependence. And he advocated a return to what he called the Tao, the way, where the human heart was seen as being capable of attaining goodness with its own resources and not simply as a matter of consuming commodities. So those two books, there it is.
Two books and a conference. That is plenty of follow-up, I think, for people. Mark, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.